You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shape this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 44 of the Great Plains Podcast. I am your host, Professor Carlton Shieldchief-Gover, and I am thrilled to have you join me on this exciting journey through the rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. We are continuing on our series of Plains Anthropologist articles, and tonight I am joined by John Lambert and Dr. Thomas Label. John Lambert is an assistant research scientist at the Illinois State Archaeological Survey. He earned his BS in anthropology and master's certificate in GIS from Iowa State University in 2009 and an MA in anthropology from UC Davis in 2011. His current research focuses on the Pleistocene and early Holocene archaeology of the Mid-Continent and Western Great Lakes. This includes work on hunter-gatherer mobility and stone tool technologies, GIS-based site probability modeling, and regional analysis of how human demography, migration, and subsistence respond to large-scale environmental and social change. Dr. Thomas Label is a principal research scientist and assistant director at the Illinois State Archaeological Survey. He earned his MA in 1998 and PhD in 2005 in anthropology from the University of Illinois Chicago. He specializes in the archaeology of the late Pleistocene, early Holocene period of North America, with particular emphasis on the Midwest and Western Great Lakes regions. His technical specialties include the organization of lithic technology, high-power microwave analysis, experimental archaeology, geophysical survey, cultural resources management, underwater archaeology, public archaeology, and outreach and education. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining me this evening. How are you both doing? We'll start off with John.
Excellent. Thanks for having us today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. And Tom, how about you?
Doing great. And thanks for the invitation. We're excited to talk about this.
Absolutely. So the article that these gentlemen recently had published in Plains Anthropologist is titled Addressing a Gap in the Late Pleistocene Record of the Midwest, Fluted Points in Northwest Missouri and Southwest Iowa. So like this is looking on the eastern periphery of the Great Plains, well within the target area. And so just starting us off, and I'll let you two decide who wants to break the ice here. Looking at this archaeological gap that you guys bring attention to in Northwest Missouri and Southwest Iowa, right across the river from where I live, why has this region remained patchy or underrepresented in Paleo-Indian research?
Well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with just the history of the discipline and where the first well-documented Paleo-Indian sites were located. You know, really early on, you had a whole bunch of sites, say like Lindenmeyer and Blackwater Draw and places out on the plains that had good stratigraphy and dates, and that record really became strongly associated with the plains. And kind of by contrast, in the Midwest, while sort of some early reports of fluted points or fulsomoid points, as they were often kind of called, they trickle in over the decades, but there really were no comparable sites with good, deep, stratified records that could kind of anchor that record in the Mid-Continent. So it was kind of this continuing frustration. And then paired with that, you had a historic emphasis on, you know, the regional archaeology of mound sites, rock shelters, you know, late pre-contact agricultural sites with things like earth lodges, ceramic chronology. So sometimes the answer is the record's hard to find. Sometimes it's really simple. It's just nobody's ever bothered to look for that kind of archaeology in a particular area.
Yeah, it's really, and to kind of reinforce what John was saying, it's a historical bias. Okay, so where did some of these early sites come from that really defined some of these Clovis and Folsom complexes? And then there's been a sustained focus on those areas and a lack of focus in other areas. So in the Midwest here and in Illinois in particular, I call it the shadow of Cahokia. you know, here you have this gigantic site that you can walk out and see it, right? Monumental earthworks and the cultural material of these habitation sites is exceedingly rich and easy to find, frankly, versus chasing an archaeological signature that is a lot more difficult to detect. It's ephemeral, it's sparse, and it's reflecting a much less populated landscape. So the archaeology isn't easy, and it takes a really long time to kind of build enough data to understand your region. So a lot of it is just this historical focus on, you know, on the plains and on these early elephant kill sites. I always say, what's easier to find, an elephant bone or a fluted point? You know, and so it's these sites that have continued to direct and misdirect a lot of our effort and perception of Paleo-Indian culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Like survivorship bias, especially in the eastern part of the Great Plains, I can imagine having a huge effect on the accessibility of these late Ice Age complexes like Clovis and Folsom. Like they're going to be buried in deep soil horizons. Whereas like in Wyoming, Colorado, you guys mentioned Lindenmeyer, Blackwater Draw, like they're closer to the surface. There's not as much soil turnover out that way. And so with that in mind, like what were the previous understandings of Clovis and Folsom occupations in the mid-continent?
That's a good question, Carlton. And I'd say it's our understanding of the Midwest historically is based on everywhere else. Again, so going back towards these Blackwater Draw and Lindenmeyer and these famous sites, right? And the elephant kills that have garnered all of the attention. And what that has led to is we interpret from the plains and these other places back into the Midwest and make assumptions about adaptations and cultural connections and other things. So historically, it's been based on everywhere else.
Understood.
Yeah, I mean, people have known for a long time that some of this early fluted point material existed in the Midwest. But like Tom said, a lot of the understanding or kind of lack thereof of what these groups were actually doing in the mid-continent is all based on analogy with the plains. There aren't very many sites with direct dates or with intact deposits with good spatial integrity or datable material or activity areas or structures or anything like that. And especially we don't have the same record of preserved faunal remains associated with this material either. So it's just a lot more difficult to make those same kinds of detailed statements about lifeways. So for a long time, really, people didn't know that much about that record here.
So turning back towards keeping this with you, John, so can you give us an overview of the 235 fluted projectile points that were documented in this study and, you know, the discussion of the 44 points that you guys analyzed?
Yeah, sure. So of those 235 points, about half are from published sources. A lot of those are ones that were originally reported on by Chapman in the 70s. So it kind of becomes this, you know, the archaeology of the archaeology to try and track down those records and get good published photographs and line drawings and actually vet, okay, that fluted point that Chapman is referencing is actually a Clovis point or actually a Folsom point. Because even as late as the 60s and 70s, there's still some typological confusion between things like Dalton, you know, and say Clovis. So we really have to go back and do a lot of detective work to track down photos and drawings of those original published sources from Chapman's maps to figure out, okay, what are we actually looking at here? So we were able to track down records for 128 of those published points, 27 points from museum collections. So places like the Gilcrease Museum have fantastic records from some really early collections from the region. You know, 67 points from private collections. So that includes the 44 from the David Easterly collection, as long as a couple other ones. And we can talk about that in a little bit. We're trying to, you know, really ramp up our efforts in Missouri and Iowa. So we're hoping that number goes up in the future. We have a few points that were shared with from other archaeologists like Brad Koldehoff in Illinois, as well as a handful from kind of other published sources and photos that we could get good information on. But they span say the northern two-thirds of Missouri and the southern third of Iowa. That's the window we're looking at here.
Okay, excellent. And so it's probably best for us to, you know, define like what defines a fluted projectile point. So over to you, Tom, like what is fluting? What is that process and how do we get these fluted points?
So the fun thing about these artifacts is they're instantly recognizable. They're very distinctive and they are very sensitive chronological markers. So they're like fossil index, you know, kind of artifacts. When you see a Clovis point and or a very similar but related, you know, Folsom points, you can pretty much know exactly that you're dealing in the, you know, 13,000 year ago time frame. The distinctive things about these are the manufacture process. And by fluting, what they did is they removed a large flake from the base of the point up towards the tip, which had the effect of thinning that down, which we assume is for an efficiency in hafting. But they have these large flakes running up from the base towards the tip on both sides. We call them channel flakes, or fluting is the more popular term. They're very distinctive, and it's pretty much the only time in North American prehistory that this style of artifact was made. So it really becomes a nice index fossil in terms of, you know, how we think of like fossils as geological markers and time frames like that. It's the same with stone tool technology. And so it's this removal, which we assume is for an efficiency in hafting, these flakes driven up from the base towards the tip. Clovis tend to be a little more larger, a little more robust and thicker. Folsom points are a little more diminutive. They have a lot more pressure retouch on them. They're very thin, but still with that same large channel flake removal, with Folsom tending to be more fully fluted all the way to the tip and sometimes beyond. We see a lot of manufacturing failures that take the tip of that preform completely off, but sometimes they intended to do it. So part of the question is, why do humans do things that are technologically difficult but stylistically distinctive? Did this manufacturer or this distinctive manufacturer, was it so much more effective for hafting that it conveyed some kind of advantage? But it also relates in a very high manufacturing failure. So there's risk involved there. So are they that much more effective that you're going to, you know, kind of risk the higher rate of failure? And so that's the kind of the interesting thing about the styles of these points and the difficulty in the manufacture. These are some of the most finely crafted weaponry tips in all of prehistory. And again, we tend to think of this very teleological kind of things progress from simple to more complex. But here, the earliest stone weapons are some of the most technologically difficult to make than things that come thousands of years afterwards. So, you know, they're really interesting. They're a great diagnostic. But at the same time, that we've obsessed with the question of, well, how were fluted points made for the better part of 100 years, which, you know, is an interesting question. And it's something fun to think about, but it doesn't really tell us about, you know, why did they do that? You know, there's social implications, there's stylistic implications. And it, you know, so we've obsessed over certain parts of Paleo-Indian archaeology. How do you make a fluted point? You know, that doesn't tell me a lot, that much more about the bigger picture of things I want to know about. And with this historic emphasis on elephant kills and, you know, Wyoming and certain areas being kind of the epicenter of a sustained research effort, it's really led to Paleo-Indians and Clovis and Folsom people being some of the most highly stereotyped archaeological cultures in North America. If I say Clovis, 9 times out of 10, people are going to think about somebody throwing rocks and spears at an elephant. But that's highly unlikely that's all they did. And that's what they did everywhere across the entire continent. So, you know, we really don't know much about or understand much about the nature of Paleo-Indian social complexity, why they did certain things, but we do know that they adapted very rapidly to a continent-wide variation in environmental differences and resource structures. And the one thing we do know about hunter-gatherers is they adapt to regions, and what works in one region may not work in another region.
Right. That's one of the really interesting things about documenting this really robust Clovis and Folsom record. Folsom especially is, I mean, man, people think Folsom and they think bison hunting on the plains. That's the deal. But, you know, we have really extensive Folsom records that span all the way, you know, across Missouri, Iowa, Illinois, up into southern Wisconsin, and even into the western edge of Indiana. So it can't have been about bison during that time period, because they weren't in those regions at that time, especially places like Illinois and Wisconsin. So kind of to Tom's point, that just the widespread distribution of these point styles, I mean, that tells you right off the bat that these groups are a lot more behaviorally flexible than people have often assumed in the past.
Excellent. That gives us something to chew on here during our first break. We'll be right back with episode 44 with Tom and John after these messages. And welcome back to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. So getting into the results of the study, what exactly, after you guys analyzed all these projectile points from the late Pleistocene, what were your results? What did it entail?
So kind of in a nutshell, the points in the Easterly collection, they really strongly cluster in northwest Missouri and extreme southwest Iowa. You know, think kind of along the Missouri River and some of its tributaries like the Nottoway and the Nishnabotna that go kind of north-south up into southwest Iowa. And when you pair that with the distribution of points and the use of specific raw materials in this larger sample that we put together from the published literature and other private collections, you see this pattern of really strongly directional east-west movement over, say, 200 to 300 kilometers, kind of along the Missouri and the Osage and then some of the tributaries of the Missouri, and then kind of up the Mississippi and into southeast Iowa. And that's a little different between Clovis and Folsom. One of the strongest differences between those two parts of the data set, the Clovis component has a big inclusion of these local Pennsylvanian cherts from northwest Missouri and southwest Iowa, but it's got a really strong minority of Burlington chert that outcrops a couple hundred kilometers to the east. So it seems like Clovis groups are probably doing this east-west, you know, whether that's a seasonal round or a long-term kind of at time average pattern of mobility is a little harder to say. But the Folsom component is much more heavily dominated by those local Pennsylvanian cherts. And that's something that we've seen similar sorts of patterns in the Great Lakes also, that, yeah, Folsom and Clovis groups are both really mobile, but Folsom seems to have a little bit more strongly patterned, redundant use of particular parts of the landscape and a little more focus on particular key areas. Clovis definitely has these consistent, strongly directional patterns of movement, but Folsom seems to be much more concentrated in particular areas.
I do have to ask, just because when you mentioned it in the last segment about, you know, bison aren't out here, out in this part of the continent. So what are people hunting out in the mid-continent with, I know this was a part of what we talked about before. This is my just general interest. Like, what are people actually hunting with these Folsom and Clovis technologies?
Well, I should say that probably varies between parts of the mid-continent. So yeah, sorry if I wasn't very clear earlier, but say southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois in particular, bison are not there until 8,000 or 9,000 years ago.
Right. There's 1,500 to 2,000 year gap between the Folsom folks appearing in that area and the earliest bison record. So bison, it's highly unlikely that bison are some kind of a predictable, aggregated, noteworthy resource that's going to attract these folks' attention to come in, you know, often on the scale of 1 to 200 kilometers away. So something else is there, right, that's getting their attention and is drawing them into that area. But you know, if you say Folsom, people are going to think about bison kills out on the plains. So again, when I was talking about these continent-wide adaptations and assumptions of how people are adapting and what we think of Clovis people doing and elephant hunting and Folsom people bison, there's got to be a lot of variation in cultural adaptation and primary prey species and what drives these large mobility patterns across large areas. And so Folsom in Illinois and Wisconsin is a great example of that because, well, yeah, out in western Iowa and in the plains, they're certainly hunting bison. We know that 100%. Yeah. But if there's no bison in the paleontological record in Illinois and Wisconsin, that means there's something else that's drawing their attention. So,
gotcha.
Taking these big data sets and thinking about them on large scales, right, allows us to look at these patterns and then start to chew on them and think about these kinds of questions.
Yeah, gotcha. I mean, even and sort of in the area that we were looking at for this study, you know, say northern, mostly northern Missouri and southern Iowa, even by Clovis times, you have this time transgressive pattern of environmental change and reorganization where, you know, by 14,000 years ago, certainly you've got, you know, mixed kind of oak hickory forest and plains moving up through Missouri into southern Iowa. But at that time, you actually still have some spruce parkland in southern Iowa. So even across this smaller area in the mid-continent, it probably varied what people were keying into. So potentially something like caribou or, you know, muskox, you know, stag moose. We'd know from the paleontological record there are some of these other Pleistocene critters that are still around in the region at that time. But yeah, it probably is almost certainly bison in Missouri, you know, by the tail end of the Pleistocene, for sure, by the time you get to Folsom times.
Gotcha. And so, you know, kind of getting back to me getting us derailed and looking at these two major foci, right? Like you look at your guys's cluster maps for Clovis points, as you were talking about, John, versus your cluster points for Folsom, where Clovis is showing much heavier along the Missouri River near St. Louis. I don't know my Missouri geography that well, so central Missouri, but you're, as you were saying, you have a larger Folsom cluster of points coming out of southwest Iowa, northwest Missouri. So what do these differences begin to reveal?
Yeah, Carl, that's a hard question to answer on some levels because, you know, we have to freely admit that we're working with a biased data set here in a couple of different ways. Number one, we're looking at weaponry tips. Okay, so we're biased towards weaponry and presumably hunting activities. Plus, we're also looking at an area that's seen patchy research. And so we still don't have the full picture about distributions in other portions of the state. One of the things that started to draw us into Iowa and Missouri was we wanted to know how these areas were interacting with the other side of the river, you know, Illinois and Wisconsin. There's got to be some connectedness. And what does that tell us about, you know, we know these people are coming in. If you look at the early archaeological sequence in Illinois and Wisconsin, it's heavily plains influenced. You see the same kind of stratigraphic sequence and typological. As you get into the further eastern Great Lakes, that breaks off and does something a little bit different in after Clovis, right? But in Illinois, Wisconsin, we have Clovis, Folsom, Agate Basin, Cody Complex, the same kind of point type sequence that we see out on the plains. So we know there's a connectedness here.
And that's one of the really cool things about this region is that, you know, Missouri and Iowa are in this really interesting sort of boundary between the eastern plains and the eastern woodlands. So, you know, yeah, we know there are these obvious historical connections between the plains and the Midwest and where groups are probably originating from. And you see that all the way through, you know, say Agate Basin, at least, and into Cody Complex, groups coming from the plains. But what are they doing in this sort of intervening stretch has really not been studied that much before. So, you know, yeah, we can get kind of a first stab at it with these big records that are big regional records that are mostly dominated by discarded weaponry and surface contexts. So you can say some things about, you know, the size and directionality of, I mean, really what you're looking at is lithic circulation networks. Okay, well, you can probably correlate that with certain aspects of mobility and social systems, but
to some degree, it's got to reflect the regional resource structure and predictability of resources over time or changes in that as well. And so that's the fun thing about looking at large areas. A lot of researchers find one of these early sites and they hone in on that and they go outward, right? I think it's a lot more informative to try to interpret a site from a region. To me, I get a better, or I think it's, you can ask different kinds of questions of the data by approaching it that way.
It's really hard to understand the pattern when you're looking at groups that are mobile over 200-400 kilometer ranges without zooming out to this regional scale. And that's one of the really nice things, actually, about private collections or older museum collections in this context. You know, anybody who's ever worked with private collectors knows the amount of info they record or keep about particular points varies incredibly. You might have a state or a region, or if you're lucky, maybe a county or a township, or 4 miles west of a particular town or near such and such a river. If you're trying to work at the site specific level, that kind of data is not really helpful, but you can aggregate it at a regional scale, and that level of precision, say county level or better, works totally fine. And you can actually make a lot of hay answering some questions at those levels.
Excellent. So as we're kind of winding down here and then thinking about this article, you know, and you hinted on this on working with collectors, you know, how do we get more archaeologists and professionals to work with collectors in a way that we can create more data sets like you guys have created in this study?
You know, this is a critical thing for science in general, the way I look at it. You know, we need to reach out to the public so that they understand why we do what we do and how we do it. The vast majority of the public doesn't really understand the scientific process. But that's a failure of scientists to explain the value of what we do and the kind of information that we can pull out of that and the stories we can tell in terms of archaeology. So I think, you know, it's at one scale, it's imperative just, you know, self-preservation that we do it. But on the other hand, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. There is an incredible amount of data out there if you are willing to bridge that gap and work with these collectors on a peer level relationship. They're just as interested in the archaeology as we are, albeit though in different ways, but a lot of them are, they're more than happy to share their data and contribute to something.
And there's real benefits for the discipline in doing that. I mean, yeah, you collect a lot of data, but it's also a really good opportunity to encourage, I'll say, more responsible collecting. We try and work with collectors and talk to them about why it's important to record locations and keep notes on what they find and take photos and share their information with other people and keep collections together. You know, we give a lot of talks to, you know, local avocational groups, or, you know, we go to shows and talk with people. But like Tom said, it's important that they understand why the science matters. I mean, and then everybody benefits. They collect better information. We learn more about the regional record. You know, the simple fact is always going to be that private collectors are always going to outnumber professional archaeologists. Like, there's way more of them out walking fields than there's ever going to be of us. So we can learn an awful lot by working with those kinds of groups.
Absolutely. So what's next? Now that the study's done, what is on your guys' agenda for your guys' fieldwork or research plan? Now that you started filling some of these gaps in.
Well, we're going to continue to work in these areas. And so we're really starting to pound the pavement in Iowa in particular to reinvigorate the Fluted Point survey work that was started there by Morrow and some of the other things. But again, it's been patchy and not sustained. We still have a lot to learn. And why are we interested in Iowa when we've worked so much in Illinois and Wisconsin? Working there for 30 years, we have a really strong data set with really robust patterns. But that will be enhanced by our understanding of the adjacent areas. So what's going on in Iowa and Missouri and Indiana? So we're looking outward again to the adjacent areas because we know there is a connection there. You know, we want to see how are these related or not related?
Yeah.
So we're going to continue to chase fluted points in these adjacent regions now, because it'll help us to understand our current data set for Illinois and Wisconsin.
And the reason you need to build those big data sets is because, like I said, you're largely working with a record of surface material over big areas without related assemblages. So you need big samples to be able to talk about, ooh, okay, now we see what those overlapping, you know, partially overlapping but kind of distinct lithic circulation systems look like. How big are they? Where are they in relation to each other? And then you can kind of confidently identify things like outliers, say particular points or material that are moving between groups rather than within systems. So kind of in the grand tradition of people like Chapman, who he got a lot of his data by working with private collectors and putting out this periodic call for data in the Missouri Archaeological Society newsletter, we've been doing a lot of similar things. So we've put out a call for Iowa points, and we're actually starting to see people send some stuff in. So, you know, it works. It's time tested. If you actually talk with people, they're usually willing to share information.
Absolutely. That's amazing. So for those of you that are want to read the article for yourself, dive more into the results and the study and see some amazing figures of and tables. Well, tables are tables, but see some amazing photographs of Folsom and Clovis points. The reference for this article is in the show notes, as well as a link to become a member of the Plains Anthropological Society. By becoming a member, you then get access to the quarterly journal and you get access to the full online catalog. So consider becoming a member. Reading the journal for yourself. You can get it mailed to you. You can get digital copies. It's fantastic. Come to the annual meeting this October in Lincoln, Nebraska. And yeah, and so continue to support some amazing work being done in Plains Anthropology. Tom, John, thank you guys so much for joining me, being a guest on the podcast. Really excited about this series. And as someone who is from, because I got my master's at University of Wyoming, so I'm always promoting the mammoth hunters and that research. That's my fallback because they're always doing stuff. But to bring attention to the other side of the Great Plains, what these folks at the end of the Terminal Pleistocene were doing and that they are present. So thank you guys so much. And if you guys are ever around the Kansas City area, give me a holler. I'll come meet up. We can get some barbecue since you guys will just be down the road. And with that, I will see you guys next time for episode 45. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.archpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.